It's 5 hours West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Cubans are mourning the death of 90-year-old Fidel Castro, the communist country's revolutionary leader who ruled for half a century. The cause of death, which occurred late Friday, remains unknown. The head of the dissident Ladies in White, Berta Soler, said nothing will change. Cuba remains a dictatorship. Mr. Castro had been in poor health since he nearly died of an intestinal ailment in 2006. He ceded power to his 85-year-old brother, Raul. Cuban expert Jaime Suchlicki of the University of Miami says he does not see an early end to communist rule.
Raul is now planning another succession to his military colleagues. He's grooming his son, Alejandro Castro, as part of a succession team.
The incoming White House Chief of Staff for President-elect Donald Trump, Reince Priebus, appearing on U.S. television Sunday, said improving relations between the two countries must be a two-way street.
President-elect Trump is going to be looking for some movement in the right direction in order to have any sort of deal with Cuba. I mean, it can't just be nothing, and then you get total and complete cooperation from the United States. There has to be something, and what that something is, Chris, is yet to be determined, but I can assure you that he's going to require some movement or some schedule of movement in order to then schedule some kind of relationship with Cuba.
The Caribbean island nation has entered a week of mourning with his burial scheduled December 4th. Fierce fighting between Ugandan security forces and a separatist militia believed to be loyal to a tribal king in the country's west left at least 55 people, including 14 security force personnel, dead. This is VOA News. Russian-backed Syrian allied forces pushed deeper Sunday into rebel-held eastern Aleppo. They took control of the large Hanano housing district, as well as neighboring districts. Northeastern University analyst Yasser Munif said thousands of residents have fled.
So they are mostly going to the Kurdish neighborhood in western Aleppo. Some of them are going to the regime-controlled areas, and they're basically fleeing the bombs from eastern Aleppo.
Witnesses placed the government force late Sunday inside the Sakur district, the narrowest point in eastern Aleppo. Analysts warned the fall of Sakur to forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad would effectively divide the east from north to south and, in theory, hasten the collapse of the rebel force. Modif was asked what the government's strategy is.
The opposition was able to really build interesting institution and a form of participatory democracy since then. But the regime has been bombing the city nonstop since that period. And the more recent strategy has been not necessarily to take the city, but rather to destroy the infrastructure and radicalize the population.
He said such a strategy is not always about conquering territory, but pushing rebels and the populace into the arms of radical groups like al-Qaeda. Swiss voters Sunday rejected an effort to hasten the process of phasing out the country's nuclear power plants, a result suggesting the Swiss prefer energy independence over safety concerns.
Ich bin erleichtert über diesen Ausgang.
Swiss Energy Minister Doris Lutard says she is relieved by the outcome, giving authorities time for rebuilding an energy strategy. Nearly 55% of voters turned down the initiative, with the other 45% in support. No new nuclear power stations have been built in Switzerland since 1984. Israel said it's ordering an additional 17 advanced U.S.-made F-35 stealth joint strike fighters, bringing to 50 the number expected to be delivered in the next few years. The estimated $400 billion cost is expected to give the Jewish state a qualitative edge over its regional adversaries. In Manila, Philippines police detonated a suspected bomb found just a few meters from the U.S. Embassy. There were no casualties. Police found a cell phone attached to a bottle-like cylinder wrapped in black with wires connecting both. Chinese authorities have detained 9 people involved in a power plant construction project that collapsed last week, killing 74. The accident occurred in Fengcheng in eastern Jiangxi province during work on a cooling tower for a coal-fired power plant. Oil prices fell in trading in Asia Monday as talks among the world's oil producers get underway. Members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries are meeting with non-OPEC members to discuss production cuts to bring the price of oil up. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, November 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Africa remembers the late Cuban leader Fidel Castro as a friend of the continent.
As you know, and this is well documented, that you cannot write the history of Africa without Cuba and without Castro. Cuba, through Castro, gave resources, gave soldiers to assist Africa gain independence.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission. Many in Cuba and Cuban Americans are hoping the death of Castro will bring about change in the island nation. And has Liberia's George Weah been having discussions with former President Charles Taylor in the United Kingdom?
We cannot confirm nor deny that such a discussion may have taken place. I'm sure Mr. Weah will have his evidence to prove that. What we can say is that the Congress of Democratic Change has been in discussion with a number of opposition political parties.
Wilton Tappe is the chief strategist for the Congress for Democratic Change, Liberia's largest opposition political party. Sudanese began the second of 3 days of civil disobedience today, Monday, to protest fuel, electricity, and drug price increase. Guineans are more trusting of doctors and hospitals since Ebola, and butterfly farming provides a sustainable livelihood in East Africa. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's roundup of African sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The deputy chair of the African Union Commission says the history of Africa cannot be written accurately without mentioning in a prominent way Cuba and its late leader Fidel Castro. Erastus Muecha says Cuba's involvement in Africa began at a time when the continent had few friends, beginning with the independence struggle to the fight against apartheid in South Africa to providing medical assistance to Africa. He says Cuba, through Castro, gave resources and trained African freedom fighters to assist the independence struggle. Muecha says when it came to Africa, Castro lived what he preached.
Well, first of all, we send our condolences to the family and also to the people and the government of Cuba. And of course, for Castro, as you know, and this is well documented, that you cannot write the history of Africa without Cuba and without Castro. It started with the DRC, which was Zaire at that time, with Patrice Lumumba, and continued until the liberation of South Africa from apartheid. And so Cuba, through Castro, gave resources, gave soldiers, trained combatants, and did everything he could to assist Africa gain independence and, as we said earlier, apartheid for Namibia and also South Africa. Besides that, Cuba has also been very much associated with the development of Africa. As you know, that Cuba has provided support in the form of medical doctors and has also trained a number of doctors from Africa in Cuba. And more recently, even when we had the problem of Ebola, Cuba was one of those countries, challenged as it is under sanctions, that sent doctors and did everything that they could to assist the countries that were affected by Ebola. And so Cuba has been standing with Africa and working with Africa throughout, whether it was through independence, but also during development time.
It must have been difficult, at least for some African countries in the early days. At the time, Cuba was viewed as a pariah nation, particularly by the big Western powers. So it must have been difficult then, Africa siding with Cuba.
Well, for Africa, that was not a difficult thing, because Africa has consistently sponsored a resolution through the UN, and which was always passed in the African Union, and before that, AU, calling for removal of sanctions, because every country has a right to choose the form of economic development it may wish to follow. And for Africa, we didn't think that the rest of the world had the right to choose for Cuba the course of our history. And of course, as you say, the sanctions were hurting Cuba, and we are happy to see that finally, and those that imposed the sanctions saw that they were not really achieving the objectives. And the United States, for one, was one of those countries that we have seen more recently that has taken steps to remove those sanctions.
One of the striking pictures I saw was Fidel Castro standing by Nelson Mandela as Mandela raises his fist in the air. That was very moving for me, particularly looking at that. As you said, Castro supported Africa independence, but also the end to apartheid.
Absolutely. Castro was larger than the stature that you can talk about. He was of the stature of Mandela, and through his actions, through his beliefs, because he's a man that lived what he preached. And if you've been to Cuba, I have been to, you see what he has tried to do with the people of Cuba. For instance, Cuba is one country in the world that has the highest life expectancy because of the investment he did for the people. Of course, Cuba is poor, but he went ahead to share the little he has. I mean, that is really true, what you might call humanity in him that was larger than just the individual Cuba.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chairperson of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. With the death last Friday of Fidel Castro at age 90, many residents of the communist island nation and Cuban Americans saw an opportunity for change in the country's troubled decades-long history of human rights abuses. But as viewer Catherine Gibson reports from Washington, those changes may not come easily.
Celebration in the streets of Little Havana. Cuban Americans hoping the death of one man can end decades of human rights abuses.
That a bad dictator that had Cuba under oppression and repression for almost six decades is no longer with us, and that will give an opportunity to the Cuban people to start the journey towards freedom and democracy.
Under Castro's rule, three generations of Cuban people lacked nearly all basic civil and political freedoms, with thousands of dissenters punished or imprisoned. Even the restoration of relations with the U.S. starting in 2014 didn't loosen the limitations on freedoms. The internet still severely censored, and the detention of journalists and human rights defenders stepped up. Now it will be up to Raul Castro, who has gradually taken over control of the communist island nation, to decide if his brother's death marks the end of an era, Professor Guadalupe Correa told VOA via Skype.
To change his approach to his own country and allow the country to be more open.
A hope echoed by many U.S. lawmakers taking to Twitter in the hours after Castro's death.
This represents an opportunity, especially for those freedom fighters in Cuba, the opposition leaders who have been risking their lives, their security, their well-being for years to fight for a better country. Now they're going to be stronger.
But change in the wake of Castro's death could come at a steep cost, foreign policy analyst Brian Fonseca told VOA via Skype.
Given that preservation of power is the most critical thing to the Cuban political elite, then I think that you may find repression going up, at least in the short term.
And back in the streets of Little Havana, the realization that the end of the era of Castro is in many ways just the beginning.
The people of Cuba do not have a free elections. There's no democracy. And I think those of us aren't going to rest until we see the freedom for the people of Cuba.
Catherine Gibson in Washington, VOA News.
Today's Monday, November 28th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's say shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Banga in Bong County in Central Liberia, and Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. A senior member of Liberia's largest opposition political party, the Congress for Democratic Change, CDC, says the party cannot confirm or deny an allegation made by Mr. Allen White, former chief of investigation for the United Nations Special Court for Sierra Leone, that CDC leader George Weah has had discussions with former Liberian President Charles Taylor in the United Kingdom. Mr. Taylor is serving a 50-year jail time, having been found guilty by the UN-backed Special Court for Sierra Leone for his role in the Sierra Leone Civil War. In an interview with VOA's Peter Clotty, Mr. White alleged that part of the discussion that we are supposedly had with Mr. Taylor was to ensure that there is, quote, never a war crime special court for Liberia. Wilson Tappe, chief strategist for the CDC, says the party hopes Mr. White will provide evidence to substantiate the allegations.
First thing I would say, I'm glad he said it's an allegation.
We cannot confirm nor deny that such a discussion may have taken place. I'm sure Mr. White will have his evidence to prove that. It still remains an allegation that we cannot deny or confirm. What we can say is that the Congress of Democratic Change has been in discussion with a number of opposition political parties to form an alliance or a coalition for the purpose of the ensuing 2017 election.
We believe that if Mr. Hui has credible evidence of any sort to support this allegation, he will try to make that clear and try to make that public. And we ask him to make that.
Once again, are you saying that Senator George Weah did not have any discussion with Mr. Taylor in the United Kingdom?
We cannot deny or confirm that.
By the way, making such allegation, we believe Mr. Weah is either directly or indirectly interfering in ensuing elections in Liberia. We believe he's attempting to create doubt in the minds of voters so early about the Congress of Democratic Change or Senator Weah. But you know, Jimmy, the Liberian people are intelligent to discern truth from falsity.
What about the allegations that your party, the CDC, has signed this agreement or have been in discussion also with Senator Jewel Howard Taylor, former President Taylor's wife, that Jewel Howard Taylor will be vice president and Weah will be president in the coming 2017 election?
The Congress of Democratic Change did not sign any agreement with Senator Jewel Howard Taylor. What happened 2, 3, 4 weeks ago was that three political parties headed by the Congress of Democratic Change, which includes the National Patriotic Party and the Liberia People Democratic Party, three combined to form a coalition, as I said, for the purpose of the 2017 elections. According to the agreement signed, the Congress of Democratic Change is supposed to produce the standard bearer. And the standard bearer will have to pick his five standard bearer who would not come from the Congress of Democratic Change. So there is no agreement we are aware of signed with Senator Jewel Howard Taylor as an individual.
Mr. White alleges that it's only been two people that have been publicly supportive of retributive and restorative justice, and that has been the current vice president who is running for president and Benoni Ure. None of the other candidates that I am aware of supported restorative or retributive justice. Let me get your comment first. Then I want to ask you, what is Ambassador George Weah's position on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report?
The statement that by Mr. White, that Vice President Ambassador Boakai and Mr. Ure are the only two persons who are in favor of justice in our country, solidify our belief that this gentleman is spreading something that is not correct. We go back to 2008 and 2009, and you can Google the name Mulba Molu, that is the vice chairman of operation for the Congress for Democratic Change. It's an open secret where the CDC, through its operation people, demonstrated publicly that it was in favor of the justice underscored by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's public information that the Congress for Democratic Change, headed by Mr. Weah, had been in the vanguard for retributive and restorative justice.
Do you think it is politically wise for the CDC to be associated with the party of former President Charles Taylor? And let me ask also the party of former Speaker Alex Tyler, who has been accused of corruption.
Jimmy, you know, my answer to that would be, we don't see anything wrong with it. First, the case of Mr. Taylor was charged with a crime for which he is serving term. The institution he belongs to, which is the National Patriotic Party, does not necessarily mean NPP is involved in the criminal act. So you cannot ascribe evil or criminality to dealing with the National Patriotic Party. Number two, again, the same analogy. Mr. Ellis Tyler is a member of the Liberal People Democratic Party, a former speaker who has been accused of a crime. Under our laws, Jimmy, if you are accused, you are presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Wilson Tappert is a chief strategist for the Congress for Democratic Change, Liberia's largest opposition political party. He was speaking with me from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It has been almost 3 years since the start of the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It killed more than 11,000 people and laid bare the weaknesses of public health systems in the region. VOA traveled along the path of the outbreak to find out what has changed and how the region might cope if the virus re-emerges. Jennifer Lazuta has the report from Nzérékoré in southeastern Guinea, where the epidemic first began.
At the Nzérékoré Regional Hospital, the waiting benches are full. The head doctor tells us that before the Ebola epidemic, the emergency wards saw 15 patients or so a day. Now they see as many as 40. 50-year-old Kalele Kamara and his ailing wife traveled 12 kilometers to get here. Before, and especially during Ebola, we didn't have confidence in the hospital or its staff, he says. We were scared of them, but now we come. They can help us. But medical clinics are still not where the vast majority of people here head first. There are 30 medical doctors in Guinea's Forestier region, while there are an estimated 6,000 traditional healers. Roger Kolokol Niame is their director general. He hunts for bark and leaves to treat an elderly man suffering from chest pain. We are in the Dikke forest. Trees and shrubs of all sizes line the dirt road that runs through the forest. Niamey says we can't find these plants in town. He points to some long, bright green, oval-shaped leaves. These help with general aches and pains, he says. He points to some others that look to me quite similar, but slightly more jagged. These are good for diarrhea, he says. The forest is a pharmacy. The regional Ebola epidemic started here in a forest just like this one in southeastern Guinea. If the deadly virus reemerges, experts say the first cases would likely land on a healer's doorstep. What happens next may be critical. The World Health Organization and other partners have trained hundreds of traditional healers in Guinea on infection protection and control. Niamey says traditional healers no longer think they can cure everything. He says if he's seen a disease he's never seen before, he will leave it in the hands of medical doctors until they know exactly what the sickness is. He says many traditional healers died trying to cure Ebola patients themselves. And some also passed on the virus to other patients. The symptoms, fatigue, fever, looked like other common illnesses. Healers didn't understand how Ebola was transmitted. Via the bodily fluids of a sick person. They had no protective equipment, such as gloves or chlorine. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News in Nzérékoré, Guinea.
Sudanese began the second of 3 days of civil disobedience today, Monday, to protest fuel, electricity, and drug price increases. President Omar al-Bashir's government lifted fuel and drug subsidies and increased electricity price in a bid to stop the surge in inflation and control the fall of the Sudanese pound in the black market. Khalil Tigani is a founding member of the Sudanese National Movement for Change. He says the increases are having an impact on Sudan's poor.
Actually, there was a call for civil disobedience appeared in social media a couple of days ago, calling for people not to go for work starting from Sunday, 27th of November, for 3 days.
So this is in protest against what? The price electricity and fuel?
This actually, it came as a protest against some series of economic decisions taken by the government early this month, which rising the prices of fuel and of different commodities, and the government saying that this is as a part of a procedure due to economic problems the government is facing. So this came as a protest against these economic difficulties and these procedures taken by the government.
So what are the opposition political parties? Do you think they support this civil disobedience?
Actually, the source of calling for this disobedience was unknown, actually, because it just disappeared among the social media. But later on, starting from yesterday, some political parties or opposition parties trying to support this call for civil disobedience and calling for their supporters to join this move.
Tell me, how much impact is the increase in the price of fuel or the withdrawal of the subsidy? How much impact is it having on the ordinary people in Sudan?
You know, it is not just lifting subsidy from the oil itself, but even, you know, Sudan were facing some economic crisis since the division of South Sudan or independence of South Sudan in 2011. So the government is resorting every time to raise the prices of goods and commodities in trying to solve this problem. But every time, actually, because, you know, Sudan, according to the World Bank and Sudanese government, almost half of the people are under poverty, so they can afford, you know, this increasing in prices every time without any way to solve this problem, actually.
Do people understand why the government did it? I think the government has a reason for withdrawing the subsidy.
No, they can't understand that, because, you know, this is the sixth time the government resorted to these measures in the last 10 years. Every time the government is trying to increase this under the slogan of lifting subsidies to commodities. But every time they say that, after that, things will be okay. But every time the government resorted to the same procedure. That's why now the people are fed up of this, and they can't see way out from this mess.
Aliyu Tigani is a founding member of the Sudanese National Movement for Change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. It's now time for Daybreak Africa, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with the 10th edition of the African Women Cup of Nations holding in Cameroon. Holders Nigeria and Ghana completed the lineup for the semifinals after convincing wins in their ultimate group B matches at the weekend. Nigeria's Super Falcons put four goals past double-turned Kenya in Limbe to finish tops in Group B, while Ghana overcame Mali in the other fixture in Yaounde. Both teams finished on 7 points apiece, with the Falcons on top courtesy of superior goal difference. For the semi-finals, host Cameroon will face Ghana in Yaounde, while Nigeria will battle South Africa in Limbe, both on Tuesday. Wilfred Zaha has decided to play international football for the Ivory Coast after failing to arch to the two England caps he won in friendlies. The 24-year-old Crystal Palace winger was an England under-21 team regular before stepping up to the senior side and earning caps against Sweden in November 2012 and Scotland in August 2013. But because neither match was a competitive fixture, Zaha has been able to commit to the Ivory Coast, the country's National Football Association announced on Sunday. And to South Africa, where Mamelodi Sundowns were named Team of the Year at the South Africa Sports Award on Sunday evening. It has been an impressive year for the Brazilians, having captured the Telecom Knockout and APSA Premiership titles. However, their biggest moment arrived last month when they were crowned Champions of Africa after beating Zamalek in the CAF Champions League finals. The Brazilians picked up the Team of the Year accolade ahead of the men's rowing team and the Blitzbox. To Ghana now, where Accra Hearts of Oaks reached the finals of the 2016 G6 tournament after eliminating rivals Ashanti Kotoko 6-5 on penalties at the Baba Yara Stadium in Kumasi. Both sides scored from the spot in regulation time after brilliant exchanges in the regulation time that ended 1-1. And to Egypt, where Walid Suleiman came off on the bench in the second half to score twice and create a goal for informed Nigerian forward Junior Ajayi as Haile Crouch promoted Al Nassr tied in 3-0 to move back to the top of the Egyptian Premier League on Sunday. And the new president of the Ethiopian Athletics Federation, Haile Gebrel Selassie, has advised African athletes to be disciplined so that they can invest in ventures that will provide them with income long after their careers on the track all over. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, November 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, saying have a productive week, Africa.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA,